You may recall the old TV program, Mystery Science Theater 3000. It used to show terrible old science fiction movies, and three characters provided an additional soundtrack, nonstop wisecracks about the acting, the dialogue, the sets, everything. Well, now comes a very similar idea in movie theaters. It's called Hecklevision. We think it started in Austin. Now it's happening in Portland, Oregon, at the Hollywood Theater. The theater, in conjunction with the Portland Mercury, the city's alternative weekly newspaper, is going to show Point Break with Patrick Swayze, Keanu Reeves, and Hecklevision. Eric Henriksen is senior editor at the Mercury and joins us now. And first of all, tell us what happens with Hecklevision.
Okay, well, Hecklevision is, we play the movie on the big screen, and then the general idea is that unlike every other screening where people text anyway and ruin everything, we encourage texting and it's allowed, and they're able to text comments and text commentary and text heckles and text jokes, and as soon as they hit send on their phone, it pops up on the bottom of the screen next to their username.
Okay, so a week from Friday night, I gather, people will see the 1991 surfer skydiving bank heist movie Point Break, which has lines in it like this.
You can't just walk up to those guys. You have to get out there and learn the moves, get into their head, pick up the speech.
You're trying to tell me the FBI is going to pay me to learn to surf?
To which I would text, wait till you see what the GSA will pay you to do.
No, I heard that clip and I got super excited because I love this movie, but I heard a rumor that you didn't like this movie. I have to call you on it. Is that true?
I've never actually assembled a 10 worst list, but it would be, by my taste, it's entirely subjective, a serious competitor.
No, tell me why. I mean, we can agree to disagree and we won't ever be BFFs on it, but I'm just curious, how do you not love a movie in which Keanu learns to surf from Patrick Swayze and then they go skydiving?
And they rob banks with masks of presidents. And somehow,
yeah, I forgot that part. There's that part?
That's the whole movie. That's
it?
The whole movie, Eric.
Oh, but you say that like robbery. That's not enough.
No.
Oh, it's so great.
No. I would never say there's not enough of this. As I recall, it goes on forever.
It is. It's like 2 hours long.
Listen, if lots of people text while they're watching the movie, doesn't it start to doesn't it get crowded with text? Or how long
well,
do they
text,
stay up on the screen?
They kind of scroll. I think we usually have about 5 lines of text at the bottom of the screen. And then anytime somebody else texts, it kind of bumps the top text off the screen and the new one comes up from the bottom. So during the slower parts of the movies when people aren't being smartasses, it can stay up there for a few seconds. Mm-hmm. But during, I think any part when Gary Busey's going to say anything, I think it's going to blow up. So when that happens, that scrolling is going to go pretty quick. So you better have a short joke and it better be punchy and you better be able to type it really quick.
Right. This is a bit like sitting around your living room with 300 to 500 friends and watching a movie and talking about it.
Yeah, it's been interesting watching how unfun it is to go to movies these days between how much they cost and the ads that they cram down your throat beforehand and everybody texting and talking all the way through. And it's been interesting watching theaters kind of have to adapt to that and have to offer more than we're just going to play something on a big screen. And this is kind of something like that, which is kind of a communal experience. And it is something that you would do with some buddies and some beers around a TV. But in this case, you're doing it with, like 300 of them.
Well, Eric Henriksen, as someone once said, adios, amigo.
You too, brah. You too.
Eric Henriksen, senior editor at the Portland Mercury, co-sponsor of the Hecklevision program at the Hollywood Theater.
Just feel what the wave is doing. Then accept its energy, get in sync, and charge with it. You don't need to see.
Yeah, right. Vision is highly overrated.
Okay, Johnny, this one's got your number on it. Let's jam.
Talk with Iranians about their country's recent history, and someone may well mention the year 1953. In that year, a CIA-sponsored coup overthrew Iran's prime minister. The writer Christopher de Beleg says the coup permanently changed Iran.
I think you can say that it's possible that the history of Iran would have been very different. A slow, hesitant, but nevertheless robust period of reform would have taken the country towards something comparable to a liberal democracy.
Dibaleg is a British writer married to an Iranian. In 2009, as protests shook Iran, Dibaleg was visiting Iranian archives. He was writing a book called Patriot of Persia about the prime minister overthrown in 1953. He talked about this with Steve Inskeep.
So this man, Mohammad Mossadegh, you've got a picture of him on the cover of your book. Bluntly, he's an old man. He's hardly got any hair, very long nose. What was it about this figure that made him so charismatic, so attractive to Iranians?
I think the criteria by which Iranians judged their leaders was not their physical attractiveness or more superficial qualities of that kind, but this shining integrity that he had, this ability that he had also to connect with ordinary Iranians. He was a princeling by birth, but by the time he came to power, more egalitarian currents were swirling around the country. And in many ways, he personified those. He lived extremely simply. I think you could possibly compare him in terms of the combination of eccentricity, both physical and also the way that he behaved, which could be extremely eccentric, he can be compared to Gandhi.
What was eccentric about his behavior?
He was a terrible hypochondriac. He would be transported by fainting. He would spend long periods of time in an iron bed in his house. During the period from 1951 to 53, when having nationalized the Iranian oil industry, he was visited by one after another of these foreign envoys. He wasn't always ill. That was one thing that it was almost a tactic that he used.
Now, you said when he nationalized the Iranian oil industry, we're beginning to get to the reason that this man was ultimately overthrown in a coup.
This is absolutely true. He came to power. Iran's oil industry had been developed. Oil had been discovered by British entrepreneurs. And ultimately, the British crown had come in and become a shareholder in this company, the Anglo-Persian, later the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And one should pause to acknowledge the role that British engineers and ingenuity had in this process. But it was a long process. And by the time the Iranians realized just how valuable this oil was, they came to the conclusion that they were being fleeced. And so a groundswell of opposition to the company arose. And by the time Mossadegh came to power, he had in fact engineered the passage of a nationalization bill through the parliament. So he came to power having to deal with the results of that vote in parliament, which was how to live with the disapproval and the outright opposition of the British.
And ultimately the Americans.
The Americans were, to begin with, quite favorable towards Mossadegh because they thought that Mossadegh was acting as a bulwark against communism, and America, as we should remember, was exercised above all by its extreme fear of communism at the time. The British argued that no, Mossadegh was in fact a stalking horse for the communists. He had friends who were communists, and they said that for as long as Mossadegh is allowed to stay in power, not only will our oil rights be trampled upon, but also the country will face the risk of falling into communist hands.
The result here was a king who'd been relatively powerless before, who became very powerful and was a brutal ruler by many accounts for a quarter century, and then was replaced by an Islamic revolution that has had its own brand of brutality. That's quite a consequence from that coup in 1953.
It is, and I don't think anyone at the time could have foreseen that. However, it is worth noting that there was a journalist from the New York Times called Kenneth Love who wrote extremely evocative pieces about the coup at the time. He had a small part to play in the coup because publicising the cause of the new prime minister became central to the coup plotters' plans. Later on, he wrote a paper in which he expressed his regret at that, and he effectively said, we have unlocked something that we didn't intend to unlock. We have associated ourselves with a regime that is increasingly distrusted and detested by the Iranians, and I fear for the future, both in terms of our own prestige and also in terms of Iran's future hopes of prosperity and happiness.
Does the coup that overthrew Mossadegh still pollute the relationship between the United States and Iran?
I think it has probably contributed. It was the first time that America, which had until then been regarded more or less as a friendly, neutral, relatively benevolent outside power, It was the first time that that image was severely damaged. And America went overnight almost from being this benevolent outsider and gained an image that was almost entirely negative. And that continued. But it's worth remembering, and something that I always find very telling, that when the American embassy was taken over by the hostage takers at the beginning of the revolution...
In 1979,
those CIA officers who were interrogated by the Iranian so-called students at the time recalled later on that it felt to them as though these students were taking out on them, the CIA officers, the anger and the resentment that had been felt since 1953. It was as if the CIA officers were paying the price for the actions of their predecessors back in 1953.
Can I just tell you that a few years ago I was having dinner with an Iranian in Tehran, and he said, you know, if your country and my country are to get along, you Americans need to stop thinking about 1979 and the hostages, and my country needs to stop obsessing about 1953 and the coup.
Well, I think your dinner companion has it absolutely right. I think new history has to be allowed to intervene, a new, more hopeful history, which is why the absence of proper political relations between the two countries, the absence of cultural and other encounters between them, means that when people think of the great events in the history of the two countries, they think of these running sores that are still so painful. New history has to come in and occlude and obscure these old events for them to be forgotten.
Christopher Debleg is the author of Patriot of Persia, a biography of Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
As for the broader economic outlook, we have news from the Federal Reserve. Yesterday, the Fed unsealed the minutes from its latest open market committee meeting. NPR's Chris Arnold reports on what was said.
In these meetings, Federal Reserve officials talk about their predictions for where the economy is headed next, and so analysts scour the minutes as soon as they're released. This time around, Fed officials appear to have plenty of concerns, but they still think that the economy is recovering.
The economy is growing at a moderate pace.
That's Paul Edelstein, an economist with IHS Global Insight.
That this moderate pace will continue and probably pick up down the road. Jobs will be created and the unemployment rate will come down.
With Europe in rough shape, Fed officials did say that that posed a, quote, significant downside risk to economic activity. They're also uneasy about what's called the fiscal cliff. That's the deadline coming up at the end of this year for Congress to deal with expiring tax cuts and make some major budget decisions.
The Bush tax cuts, the temporary payroll tax cuts, extended unemployment benefits, and to solve the debt ceiling crisis from last summer, about $1.2 trillion in spending cuts are also supposed to take effect.
The political battle over all that could definitely have an impact on the economy. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Okay, well, let's move now from the world of fake meat to the world of insanely expensive meat. A few months ago, our last word in the business segment was a hot dog in Canada that cost $100, the most expensive hot dog in the world. Well, that wasn't the last word on expensive hot dogs. Now comes something called the one dog. Price tag, I'm not joking, $1,500. It's topped with lobster tail and contains saffron aioli, and it's also covered in gold dust. The creator, hot dog Mike Giuliano, admits that the gold doesn't really add any flavor. Well, it must do something, because the Little Rock, Arkansas hot dog cart owner was able to sell four of his creations. He donated the proceeds to charity. That's the business news here on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. The United States is in the middle of a natural gas boom. These days, a community can find itself not simply with one or two new wells, but suddenly surrounded by them. And that has some locals worried. Their biggest concern is that the chemicals used in gas production are causing everything from nosebleeds to cancer. But scientists see it differently. They say the evidence of harm just isn't convincing. To find out why there's such a disconnect, NPR's John Hamilton visited the small town of Dish, Texas.
Look at a satellite image of Dish, and you'll see an odd patchwork. There are ranch-style homes and green pastures, but there are also rectangles of gray-blue gravel. Zoom in a bit, and you can see they're filled with gas wells, compressors, storage tanks, and metering stations. Bill Zisko is the mayor of Dish, and he has a message for anyone who expects to see gas drilling in their town.
Run! Run as fast as you can. Grab up your family and your belongings and get out.
Zisko says he can't leave. He owns too much property here that no one wants to buy. So he took over as mayor last year after the previous mayor and his family left to get away from the drilling. Zisko's an imposing guy. Black boots, black sports coat, aviator sunglasses. He shows me around town. About 225 people live here among the gas wells. In some areas, there's the sulfurous odor of escaping gas. In others, you can feel the rumble of compressor engines big enough to power a locomotive. Zisko says things were very different when he moved here in 1987.
This place was absolutely beautiful. It was serene. It was very quiet, very clean. I raised five children here.
Then, around 2005, two things happened to the town, which was named Clark at the time. First, Clark became Dish as part of a deal to get free satellite TV service from the Dish network. Second, energy companies arrived and began drilling lots of gas wells. The wells were made possible by a technique known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, which released natural gas trapped in the hard shale a mile underground.
We're going to take a left on this dirt road right here in front of the truck.
Zisko has brought me to the biggest thing in Dish.
We can just pull right up to the gate here.
It's a swath of gas wells and heavy equipment that stretches for a quarter mile. Zisko says emissions from this site aren't safe to breathe.
It's just a who's who toxic chemical mix. Pretty much all of those items that you get from petroleum products are spewing into the air in this area.
A few years ago, the town spent $15,000 on an air quality study. It found elevated levels of several chemicals, including benzene. But since then, energy companies have fixed some problems, and the state installed a device that constantly sniffs the air for pollution. It shows levels are generally within government limits. And when state health officials came to check for toxins in residents' blood and urine, they found no cause for concern. Even so, Zisko firmly believes that people in Dish have been hurt.
There's not a lot of residents right around this facility, but within a quarter of a mile, half a mile of this facility, there's been six people die of cancer here. And so do I think that this is a concern? Yes, I do.
Zisko is pretty convincing. And even scientists who are skeptical about his claims say they understand why he's concerned. But they also say the scientific evidence that gas production around Dish has made anyone sick is pretty weak. To understand why, I go see Brian Schwartz, an environmental epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. I ask him what would it take to figure out whether there really is a link between gas operations around Dish and those people with cancer.
My answer to that would be you can't. You can't study that right now because it takes about 20 years, let's say, for solid tumors to develop after exposure to a chemical. So if the drilling has happened in the last 5 years, I cannot answer the cancer question right now.
Schwartz says even if more time had passed, a half dozen cancer cases probably wouldn't mean much, unless they were all the same type of cancer.
Cancer is not one disease. Cancer is 100 different diseases. So if that person has leukemia, that person has lung cancer, and that person has ovarian cancer, it's not a cancer cluster. Those three cancers all have very, very different causes.
Health officials in the U.S. check out more than 1,000 suspected cancer clusters each year. They almost never find anything. Of course, cancer is just one of the concerns in Dish. The previous mayor, the guy who left town last year, is Calvin Tillman. Tillman says he got worried when his two sons began getting nosebleeds. Then one night, he says, his younger son had a nosebleed that got really bad.
Our house literally looked like a murder scene. There was blood down the wall in the hallway. And I got up the next morning to go to work, and my wife said, "That is it." And at that moment, we decided we've got to move out of here.
Tillman moved his family off the shale to a town called Aubrey. He says back when he was still mayor, he realized that scientists wouldn't pay attention to just one story like his. So he had residents fill out a health survey.
Do you have itchy eyes? bloody nose, runny nose, scratchy throat, things like that. And it came back that about half the people that were polled had a symptom that could be related to one of the chemicals that we found in our air study.
But scientists say the mere presence of a chemical isn't enough. You have to know how much people were exposed to and for how long. Tom LaPointe is a toxicologist at the University of North Texas in Denton, about 15 miles east of Dish. He's also part of a task force looking at the impact of fracking. LaPointe says modern testing equipment can detect chemicals at levels far, far below those known to hurt anyone.
I've had people get quite upset saying, well, we can measure benzene. Well, yes, we measured benzene, but the concentrations are below the effect level. And that means something. That really does.
LaPointe says even if tests do find enough of a chemical to cause health effects, there's another scientific hurdle. Researchers need to know whether the pollutant is coming from local gas operations or some other source, like cars and trucks. LaPointe says that's hard to figure out in a place like Dish because it gets so much of its air pollution from the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
So ironically, even though we're not by any means the largest county in the Metroplex, we have the worst air quality because the general winds bring it up from Dallas and Fort Worth over Denton County,
where it mixes with the pollutants from gas production. So you've got two mayors from one small town making some big claims. And you've got scientists who say those claims aren't backed by solid evidence. But are the mayors wrong to say that gas production is a hazard? Brian Schwartz, the epidemiologist from Johns Hopkins, says no one knows. And he says that's a big problem.
When these areas are developed, thousands to tens of thousands of wells are drilled and fracked. So the magnitude is huge. And frankly, the development is way out ahead of public health evaluations of any kind to date.
Schwartz says that's not fair to Dish or any other place where people are worried about the health effects of drilling and fracking. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Those who want to raise standards on student achievement tests have suffered an embarrassing setback in Florida. The state made its writing exam harder and results plummeted. So the state is backtracking. It's now lowering its passing score and admitting something went wrong. Sarah Gonzalez of member station WLRN has that story.
About a dozen Florida school superintendents were at a conference in Orlando this week when the results of the state's new writing scores came in. The mood?
Disbelief, really, just like you just witnessed a car crash, and almost an intentional car crash.
Tim McGonigal is superintendent in Manatee County. He says everyone was expecting fewer students to pass, but not that few. Last year, 81% of fourth graders passed. This year, only 27% did. And when Florida Education Commissioner Gerard Robinson saw the dramatic drop,
I realized that overnight students all of a sudden just didn't become bad writers and had to figure out, was it a scoring challenge or was it a challenge with the raising of standards and rigor?
The State Board of Education called an emergency meeting and voted unanimously to lower the passing score immediately so more kids pass. Superintendent McGonigal calls it a knee-jerk reaction.
For them just to put a Band-Aid on this issue, we're going to have this problem again next year and the year after that. If you're going to change the way you score, that needs to be something that happens over a multi-year period with tremendous amount of professional development for teachers.
The education commissioner admits the state didn't do a good job telling teachers the test would be graded differently. Roxana Eldon agrees. She teaches 10th grade writing in Miami, but she says putting a Band-Aid on the issue is better than doing nothing.
Personally, as a teacher, I would rather see them try to put a quick fix on this then suddenly tell 3/4 of my students that they're failures.
The stakes are high. If students don't pass the state's reading test, they can be held back. And the stakes are high for teachers, too.
My job is on the line, yes.
Ashley Knott teaches 8th grade language arts in Orlando. Standardized test scores make up 50% of every Florida teacher's evaluation. Next year, that evaluation will determine how much teachers get paid and whether they keep their jobs. Knott says teachers are starting to question whether the state's other standardized exams are even reliable.
It is very worrisome when we hear how the writing scores came back. What's going to happen with the reading scores? What's going to happen with the math scores?
Supporters of tougher standards still say it was time to raise the bar in Florida. Patricia Levesque is with the Foundation for Florida's Future, founded by former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. In the past, Levesque says essays were graded on things like a main argument, supporting ideas, and having a conclusion.
But really important skills like spelling, vocabulary, punctuation, grammar, those were never part of how a student's essay was scored.
State education officials are confident the results are accurate. They're holding schools harmless this year to give them a fair warning, but they're telling schools tougher standards will be back next year. And this year, they're warning of significant declines in the reading and math scores due to come out soon. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Gonzalez in Miami.
And that story is part of NPR's State Impact Florida project, exploring the effect of state policy on people's lives.